You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Heartland Politics podcast and show on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK Quad Cities NPR is the flagship public radio station in eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and we're celebrating Labor Day weekend coming up. And my topic today is one of importance in our nation's labor history, and one that I have a family connection with, which I'll hope to mention as we move on. Nearly 40 years ago, at about this time of the year, a labor dispute began in a small rural Midwestern town that pitted business against labor, but also neighbor against neighbor and union member against union member. The strike received national attention and had ramifications that I think continue to this day. Some in our listening audience may even be familiar with this story because it did have regional and national repercussions in labor and the food industry and the overall economy. The strike against Hormel in 1985 took place in Austin, Minnesota. The union local was P9. And again, some folks out there may remember this and just gave this away as far as what the topic is. And my guests are two reporters who worked for the Minneapolis newspaper at the time, and they wound up writing a book, which I highly recommend. It's called No Retreat, No Surrender, Labor's War at Hormel. I read this, and it's still timely, I feel, in the issues raised in it. And the reporters did an excellent job in describing what happened. Again, the book is called No Retreat, No Surrender, and the authors are here with me today to talk about this book and this strike and its continuing importance in the labor American labor movement. The two reporters are Paul Clauda, who's here. He was with the Minneapolis Star Tribune at the time and worked covered the food industry. Dave, spelled H-A-G-E, Dave covered labor for the newspaper. Gentlemen, thank you so much for taking the time and boning up a little on this excellent book from some time back.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, let's start. I want to turn it over to you guys just to kind of a background. Paul, if you want to kind of give a little bit of a background here on Hormel and the industry, we're going back quite a ways, but what was going on at the time that kind of led to some of these labor issues?
Well, thanks, Robin. As you said, the strike was in 1985. It started in August of that year, but the seeds of the dispute, I would argue, go back quite a ways, and I don't want to go too far back, but in a sense, this was a company, Hormel was a company that grew up in Austin, Minnesota. It was founded there. It was, for a long time, it was the flagship operation in an industry, the meatpacking industry, that underwent a lot of change over the decades leading up to the strike. There was a strike actually in Austin at the Hormel plant in 1933 that was something of a watershed in terms of taking a company that had not dealt with unions and introduced the unions to the union idea to walk to Austin. And in a way, it became a very strong union outpost for labor as Hormel, under the leadership of a guy named Jay Hormel, developed innovations that supplemented the way they negotiated the labor contracts there to give workers in Austin a guaranteed annual wage, which was something that was something of an anomaly, because in a seasonal business like meatpacking, wages could go up and down a lot, but they figured out how to sort of stabilize wages and even build in an incentive system that allowed workers to earn more money, if you will, if they meet certain quotas. So they had relative labor peace after this strike in 1933. Another big event that I think helped to precipitate the strike was a decision in Austin to rebuild an old meatpacking plant that was based there. If you have a vision of the meatpacking industry in your mind of, you know, the sort of the Upton Sinclair Chicago meatpacking mindset, you think of these tall vertical buildings that were old and, you know, sort of where the livestock came in and were slaughtered and then sort of shipped off to points around the country to provide for the sort of the meat consumption in the country. But Austin decided they wanted to rebuild and get out of that because it was a losing proposition for them. Happening in the 1970s when there were non-union competitors starting to emerge in the meatpacking business. So they wanted a new plant that would be able to compete in that environment. And at the same time, Hormel was undergoing a real transformation from a kind of a traditional meatpacking company to one that wanted to be better known and I think was already becoming better known for the kinds of consumer products that it produced. So in the building of this new plant, they almost decided to leave Austin. It was a very contentious, dragged out process that went over several years. But when they decided to rebuild the plant, the union agreed to new terms, if you will, that got rid of this guaranteed annual wage. It got rid of the incentive pay system. And in exchange, there was a decision to ensure that wages wouldn't go down as the new plant opened up. At the same time, the industry was going through quite an upheaval that, as I mentioned, non-union competitors like IBP, Iowa Beef Processors, paying workers quite a bit less than this prevailing union wage that most of the major meat packers paid back then. So in that environment, what happened, in my mind, a key precipitating event was in 1983, Wilson Foods filed for bankruptcy, took its labor rates in the meatpacking business and dropped them 40% overnight. And this was, again, coming on the heels of the 1981 recession, an incredible jolt to this industry that had been used to a period of rising wages and workers being somewhat stable in that environment. In that context, Hormel said, if we're going to compete in this business, we need wage cuts too. But they had this new plant they opened up that didn't have the ability to, they couldn't reopen the contract until 1985. So they made an overture to the union that they said they wanted to reduce wages in some fashion. And that really set off the sort of the seeds of the strike. Here was a profitable company making money and asking workers to take a pay cut, if you will. And the argument that Hormel made was embedded in that new plant agreement, which was when they negotiated that thing, they said, we're going to always pay the prevailing wage in the industry. And in 1978, when the plant decision was made to build a new one, no one thought that wages would ever fall. So this idea that, sure, we're going to tether ourselves to the industry and that will be a safe way to protect workers' wages. But then along comes 1983 and sort of a wave of upheaval in the industry that sent wages down. And that's how we got into this situation of Hormel, a profitable company, making the argument with contractual backing that it could cut wages of workers even as they were, feeling somewhat wrong by that. Dave, I know you got it.
So we have the company in an industry in upheaval and going for some labor concessions. Dave, so the union's going to fight this, right? And stay united and fight this.
Exactly, Robin. Good background by Paul, but this news to the union in Austin, Minnesota, could hardly have arrived at a worse time. Let's remember 1984, 1985, we're in the heart of the Reagan era. Morning in America, President Reagan was bringing in a new political and economic era. In 1981, President Reagan famously had fired the Patco air traffic controllers, signaling that management was going to take a new, harder line against organized labor. As Paul mentioned, in 1982, the country had been through a horrible recession. The nation's unemployment rate reached almost 11% in 1982, worse since the Great Depression. The result of all of this was that organized labor in the United States had lost a lot of power. Economically, if you went on strike, there are a lot of other people out there who wanted your job. And also prestige. Reagan had done a pretty good job of turning public opinion against unions. And so they were regarded, instead of being advocates for the middle class, they were increasingly regarded as sort of a special interest that was not representing average Americans. And in particular, Reagan's step with PATCO set this precedent. It was unspoken, but widely accepted that it was okay for management to fire workers when they went on strike. This was legal under American labor law, but it had almost never been done. It was an unspoken agreement that you tried to work through a strike and bring your people back. All of a sudden, firing workers became an accepted tactic. There were big strikes in Arizona at Phelps Dodge, a big paper mill strike in New England, where thousands of workers were fired. And that's the environment in which P9 entered this strike. The other quick backdrop was that the union local P9 had brand new militant leadership. The new president was a guy named Jim Guyette. He was an Austin, Minnesota kid, had grown up in and around the plant. Jim had been hired at Hormel in a big wave of young workers who were hired after the new plant opened. These younger workers, they placed great stock in the promises that the company had made. They really felt like they had a special relationship with Hormel, that Hormel owed them something. And so they were just furious, and they felt betrayed when the company asked for wage concessions. Guyette was elected to the P9, the union, local union executive board in 1981, and immediately became a voice for sort of the militants in the local. He was a charismatic guy. He was a good speaker. He was a good organizer, along with his wife, Vicky. They were two very good organizers. And Guyette really had a way of rallying people around his cause. And it was a watershed moment when Guyette became president. He signaled both a new militancy in local P9 and also this new younger generation of leadership that was willing to use different tactics. I would add one other thing that happened that made this strike really unusual. In the fall of 1984, local P9 hired an outside consultant, a New York labor consultant named Ray Rogers. And Rogers had built kind of a pretty big reputation on the East Coast by promising unions that he had new tactics to fight management. You could fight corporate power with corporate power. You could use boycotts and go after their bankers and put corporate pressure on these companies so that you wouldn't have to go on strike. There were these new tactics that he promised would bring management to its knees. And the hiring of Rogers had two effects. One, it made P9 a showcase for these novel new tactics in the labor movement and the promise that the labor movement, which was kind of on its back on its heels, might be re-energized with these innovative new ideas. And the second thing was it instantly made the strike in Austin national news because Ray Rogers was a gift for public relations. He was well known on the East Coast. And so all of a sudden, journalists all over the country were paying attention to this very unusual strike out there in southern Minnesota.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And we're taking a look back at an important moment in labor history that happened right in this region of the country that impacted a very important industry in the Midwest here. And if you recall, Davenport, Iowa had an Oscar Mayer plant, Monmouth down the road, a Wilson's plant at the time, Ottumwa, which plays a role in this over in a ways from here, had a plant as well. So it's about a book called No Retreat, No Surrender by Dave Hagee and Paul Clauda. And they're here, my guests today, to talk about this book and this very important moment in labor history here on Labor Day weekend. Paul, after the strike began, and you guys just both did a great job of what caused this strike, how it was different, and why it was so important at the time. Once the strike begins, what happens in the community and some of the collisions that were faced between the union and the company?
The strike period itself, I think it was started in August of 1985. And again, you have the corporate headquarters of this very successful billion-dollar company, Hormel, located in the same town as this plant, which at one point represented a third of the union workforce of the entire company and controlled 40% of its output, and now it was idle. And you had in town, you had a very odd situation of people who were, you know, on strike and, you know, upset about the situation, mad at the company. And yet these were the same people that they would often see when they, went shopping or when they, you know, ran into them on the street or in church or, you know, in other functions. So you had pretty big corporate presence in the same town as the workers who were on strike. And that really became a difficult situation to watch, I guess, as an outsider, just because you saw people who, you know, really couldn't deal with each other. It was painful. One thing also that happened in the and it started to emerge before the strike, but it became even more apparent after the strike started, was a pretty significant rift that occurred between the local union in Austin under Jim Guyette's leadership and the international union in Washington, which was trying to hold together sort of this entire industry as it was going through this tailspin. And I think the international's position was, look, we've got this profitable company. Let's use that leverage to kind of reach an agreement with Hormel that would help them sort of bring the rest of the industry up. You mentioned Swift, Morrell, and Armour, companies where workers weren't in as good a situation with their employers. So the international is taking this position that, you know, let's compromise. Guyette and the people in Austin were very much wedded to the idea that there should be no compromise with a company that's making money. So interestingly, the day after the strike started, a letter got delivered to the local union headquarters from the company saying, let's keep talking. You know, we don't want this to end up with the company reopening the plant and potentially hiring people that don't include our workers here in Austin. The union's position was, as Dave said, hey, let's put the pressure on them publicly. They didn't seem as interested in the idea of negotiating. But even as they went through the months of September, October, November, December, the international was trying to, without, you know, sort of bigfooting the local, help steer things in the direction of, hey, let's settle with these guys. We got to find a way to get the best deal possible with this company so that we can start to lift the rest of our industry up. And it culminated with a series of proposals that were hashed out. There was a mediator who was involved in Minnesota to try to bring these two sides together. The international actually got to a point where it wanted to have the union vote on a proposal and vote through the international rather than through the local because there was such great distress there. But in the end, there was no proposal that won a majority of support. I think my notes told me that one of the last deals that got voted on, what they call the mediator's proposal, this was in January, just January of 86, right, Dave? Yeah.
86.
Just before the strike, before the company reopened and had hired permanent replacements, a proposal got voted down by a 775 who said they didn't want to compromise to 540 people who voted for it. So this was a real divided union. And even that vote got questioned as to whether people really knew what they were voting on. Long story short, the company made a decision to reopen the plant on January 20th, cold morning in Minnesota. And the picket line was crossed by a number of people who were new and wanted to take these jobs that they thought were pretty good paying. And it also included a number of members of the union itself. And it really showed the rift, if you will, in the labor movement over what to do about this strike.
That's when it seemed to really, really divide the community, Dave, in reading your book, pitting families against family members against family members. You guys were in the middle of that.
As Paul said, it was extremely painful to watch. We spent a lot of time over that last year in Austin, Minnesota, Paul and me, and every time we'd drive home on a Sunday evening after spending the weekend in Austin, just with a sick feeling in our stomachs at what we were seeing. There were signs, you know, the union went into the strike with a lot of momentum. They had huge popular support, these big rallies. They had Ray Rogers. They were getting national coverage. But we started to see signs that maybe the foundation was cracking a little bit. They seemed to have a lot of popular support, but Paul and I would, for example, interview maybe a school teacher in Austin, and the school teacher might say, I don't know, those guys always made more money than we did. We couldn't afford the groceries when those Hormel guys could. And we started to realize, oh, the support for them is not universal. There are cracks here. There's some resentment. And in particular, those cracks opened up when P9 broke off, as Paul said, from the rest of what's called the Hormel chain, the other union locals at other Hormel plants. There's a lot of blame going around, but for one reason or another, P9, the Austin local, had broken off from the others, which meant that once they were on strike, they were all alone. Half of the company was still operating at other plants with other union locals, and P9 became increasingly isolated. And then this really became obvious when the company reopens the plant, January 1986, the company said to the union, we'll give you guys 2 weeks to come back to work if you want to, but after 2 weeks, if we don't have a full complement of workers, we're going to start hiring permanent replacements. All hell broke loose. About 300 workers went back. 2 weeks later, they start bringing replacements. The governor has to send in the National Guard to keep the streets open, to prevent the pickets from blocking the plant. You know, it must be said, there was almost no violence in all of this. Despite the militants of the union, their tremendous organizing, this was not a violent group of people. And even with hundreds of National Guard troops, it was not a violent strike. But it broke the town wide open. And within, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks, the plant was open. Hormel had hired 800, 900, 1,000 permanent replacements. The plant was running, and the strike was essentially broken. In March of 1986, 3 months after the company reopened the plant, the international union, the parent union, UFCW, places local P9 in trusteeship, removes Guyette and the other officers, and formally notifies the company that the strike is over.
So we have about, well, a little over 5 minutes left. I you know, and again, both of you have done the impossible in trying to take this issue and melt it down within the time limits of our show, which I'm appreciative of. There's so much more. And again, if you're interested in this, get a copy of the book. You can still get it. I got it on Amazon, and read through it. It's important for people in our region, I think, to understand this. But I'd like both of you to talk about, in the time remaining, the legacy of this. Is this still important? Does this still have implications beyond Austin, beyond even the Midwest? Paul, if you would go first.
Yeah, well, I think there are implications. I was doing some checking, because Hormel has changed quite a bit since this all played out. I mentioned earlier what a big piece of the company that operation in Austin was historically. But these days, here you've got a company that in 1985 had revenues of $1.5 billion. This year, their revenues are $12 billion. Mm-hmm. Company has evolved. They actually sold off after it reopened the plant. It sold off this slaughtering part of the business, you know, sort of the one that conjures up these historic ties to the past. They sold off this sort of low margin part of the meat business because they didn't want to be in it. Hormel is now, as most if you shop in stores, you see their products on the shelf. They're a full tilt food company that you know, they don't have this sort of old-fashioned style of meatpacking as part of its business anymore. 20,000 employees around the world. It's a far cry from the days when Austin, the workforce in Austin, was 75% of the whole company back around World War II. But in terms of implications, yeah, I've thought to myself, well, could this have been handled any, or could this have changed the way Hormel evolved? I don't think so. I think, to some degree, Hormel was already making this transition. So from the standpoint of the business, I think had the strike, you know, proven to be more successful for P9, you know, maybe there would have been a blip in terms of how Hormel functioned. But I think they had already said, you know, we're kind of getting out of this business. We're a food company. We're not going to be as heavily focused on Austin or our workers in Austin as much as that was, you know, the reason the company existed in the first place. Dave is probably in a little better position to assess the the left side of it, because I do think that it was a militant moment that I think had some spark and some after effects. But over the long haul, here we are this much later, you know.
Right.
Well, I would just share with listeners, I brought this up to people up in Minnesota and mentioned P9, and they're like, oh, it immediately lit like an emotional reaction that just P9, it still has some lingering impact on people, that was an important moment in that area up there. Dave, is there any evidence still of division? Or I understand that somebody, a formal executive, is running for Congress up there now.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think the conventional wisdom, Robin, was that P9 lost the strike. Hundreds of members of that local lost their jobs. They hired hundreds of replacements. Hormel grew and prospered. But if you look at the long run, I think that strike did change the way, not that strike alone, but strikes like it changed the way labor and management operate in this country. There's a labor professor at Cornell, terrific guy, Harry Katz, and Harry argues that this tactic of hiring permanent replacements, really using, you know, the nuclear weapon against unions, that's really gone out of favor since the 1980s. He says, you know, management of big companies just thought that was too painful, too bitter, too disruptive. And it's true, you really haven't seen much of that in the last 10, 20 years in labor relations, where management takes that hard line and just busts the union. On the labor side, you know, everybody was pretty excited about these corporate campaigns, that labor would have these brand new amazing techniques that Ray Rogers offered. I don't think that ever really panned out. There's some research that's going on where unions are trying to take on corporations in sophisticated ways. But I do think that the little flame of sympathy that P9 captured in the 1980s, Americans were beginning to understand that the middle class was taking a hit. The economy was not helping out everybody, especially blue-collar workers. And I think that idea has spread a little bit. When we look at the organizing campaigns today at Starbucks and Amazon, it's not an explicit reflection of Hormel or P9, but it's the same idea that, wait a minute, the pendulum has swung a little too far. This economy isn't working for average working people anymore, and maybe there is a reason why unions, you know, need to fight back and stand up for the interests of middle class working people.
Well, it's certainly I remember it. My dad was involved in it as an official, the union representative in Monmouth. I remember him as being part of the UFCW bargaining committee there, and it was a tough time because it pitted union member against union member, but. I agree with both of you, gentlemen. I do think it has had lingering impacts that are felt now. And again, for our listeners, I would really stress it's not just a book about labor unions or about Minnesota. It's about some key economic trends in our country's history that are still having effects today. The whole issue of income inequality, I think, and the decline of unions, I think this is where some of the seminal moments that all this took place in the mid-80s. And gentlemen, you guys did a great job of writing this book, number one, and I'm so grateful that you agreed to come on and trying to melt down this important book, a lot of detail within a half-hour time frame. So again, the book is called No Retreat, No Surrender, Labor's War at Hormel. Dave Hagi and Paul Clauda have been my guests today. Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Robin.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.